As it turned out, his colon had perforated and there was an abscess. There is no good way to distill 4 years of a medical and emotional roller coaster into a few short pages, but long story short, the infection in his gut went on for almost a month and triggered an autoimmune reaction that manifested as vasculitis, inflammation of the blood vessels, in his brain. We talked on the phone every day while he was home with a drain and IV antibiotics, but the next time I saw him in person, he couldn't walk or speak, and no one had a fucking clue what was going on. He went from Glenbrook Hospital to Evanston Hospital to Northwestern, and eventually to the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota, where he stayed for 5 months. At Mayo, while being treated with anticoagulants, he suffered a brain hemorrhage, which further exacerbated his condition. He eventually regained his speech and worked his butt off to be able to walk again, but he never really recovered. For the next 4 years, my dad underwent various therapies and treatment protocols to try to stabilize his condition as much as possible. The first 2 years were filled with horrific uncertainty. What was happening? What parts of his brain had been affected by the illness? Would he get better? Would he be able to work again? At that point, we were still hopeful that he would be able to make a significant recovery, so, in trying to protect his privacy and potential to resume his career, Erica was advised to keep his illness very quiet. While I completely understand why she chose to do that, especially in the beginning, I think that an unforeseen and unfortunate consequence of that decision was that she didn't get a lot of support, and frankly, he didn't get the outpouring of love and good wishes he deserved. Erica and Laurel Ward, his former assistant and producing partner, were his champions. At the hospital all day every day, making sure he got the proper attention from the doctors and nurses, attending to his every need, battling with the insurance company. It was endless and emotionally draining. I visited as often as I could, at least every other month and whenever there was an emergency, but Erica was the one who was present every second of every day, devoting her whole life to his care. During his illness, my dad went through periods where he would seem very much himself. During those times, he kept his doctors laughing during regular neurological exams and charmed all the nurses. He sang along to Leonard Cohen and strummed clumsily on his guitar. On those good days, he would walk, stiffly and with a lot of support, from his makeshift bedroom to the living room, where he would sit, watching Kill Bill or No Country for Old Men until it was time to shuffle back to bed. Sometimes, tired of being home, his aides would take him for pancakes at Walker Brothers or for a bowl of linguine with clam sauce at the Hole in the Wall, and he tucked into those meals with the same intensity and pleasure he'd always shown for a good meal. Early on, he would even try to do the crossword puzzles he once could breeze through. I looked at them after he was done, and they were mostly filled with gibberish, but he didn't seem to mind. At one point, as part of his therapy, Dad was asked to write a letter to his children. In it, he talked about his experiences through this difficult time. "My therapist asked me to write something about what it's like to be me, what existence feels like to me, what the experience of having a human life feels like to me. Well, it's been great so far. I used to think I was one of the luckiest guys in the world, but now I'm not so sure. Still glad to be alive, but life sucks in ways I never anticipated. I live in a world described by aches and pains and bodily inconveniences. The lessons are obvious, patience and the knowledge that I can't take anything for granted. I want to be present to share in your joys and successes, but my get up and go got up and went. But I'm working hard to come back. I just wish it was easier for all of us. Life is a precious gift. Don't waste it. I know I won't from now on." As heartbreaking as that letter is, at the time, it filled me with hope that if he was able to maintain his philosophical perspective and communicate it so clearly, maybe things weren't actually as bleak as they seemed. Those were some of the good times, when his humor and insight and spark shone through. Then there were times he would get confused and frustrated and paranoid, calling me late at night and demanding to know what was really going on. "Why can't I use my phone? I have calls I need to make. Why are people lying to me? This isn't my house. This is a hospital that they decorated to look like my house. At first, these calls were alarming, and I would scramble to say something reassuring to calm him down. Eventually, I would just listen to him, empathize with his feelings the way I did with my kids. That sounds really frustrating, and tell him to go back to bed, and I would get to the bottom of it in the morning. Generally, by morning, he had forgotten. Still, for the most part, during those first 2 years, he was probably 60 to 70% of his former self. His hearing was shot, his voice was softer, his speech was slower than it had been, and his short-term memory was shit. Because the area of his brain that had been affected by the hemorrhage controlled executive function, he lacked judgment and the ability to initiate. Still, he was essentially himself. As I mentioned before, Dad didn't get a lot of visitors during his convalescence. Initially, I assumed this was because most people didn't know how sick he was, but honestly, even among the people who did know what was going on, most were so uncomfortable with seeing him in such a diminished state that they just stayed away. The exceptions were my great-aunt Shelley and her son Ron, my dad's college friend David Cohn, Rabbi Jordan Bendat Appel, Trevor Albert, Brian Doyle Murray, and one or two other friends who came by regularly to sit with him and check in on Erica. Daniel, in high school and still living at home at the time, saw more than any child should have to see as Dad went through all the highs and lows of his illness. Ida was back at home after graduating from Tufts and spent a lot of time with Dad, cheering him on during his various therapies, watching movies, and entertaining him with elaborate mime routines and interpretive dance. Julian was still at school in the beginning, but went home as much as possible until graduation when he moved back in. Molly had come to the hospital early on in Dad's illness, and she and Amy flew to Chicago a few times once he was home. The visits were good, but I knew that Molly still felt like an outsider, so I did my best to keep her in the loop on his day-to-day ups and downs. "I just feel so bad," Molly told me when I called to let her know that Dad had asked about her. "It's like I want to be there for him, but then it seems like he has all this guilt about the past, so I end up just being a reminder of something he feels shitty about." "Molly, you know he loves you." "I know, and I love him. God, I'm sorry for even bringing this up. It's not like you don't have enough to worry about. This has got to be harder on you than anyone else." "I think it's awful for all of us in a million different ways, but honestly, I can't even imagine what you're going through. To have lived your whole life without him and then to lose him again like this? I just wish there was something I could do." "I know," she sighed. "You're already doing it. I love you. Love you too." In April 2012, Dad called to tell me that Leon had asked his permission to marry me. "Oh, really?" I asked brightly, although Leon had already told me. "What did you say?" "I said it sounded okay to me," he answered in his softer, breathier voice. "Why? Did you want me to tell him to go to hell?" "Ha ha. No, Daddy. But you're not just saying it, right? You really like him? You think it's a good thing?" My voice cracked as I spoke, and tears filled my eyes. "Oh, yeah, my baby. Very good thing. He told me not to worry, that it's his turn to take care of you, and he wants to do it forever. He's a pretty special guy, huh?" "Yeah," I sniffed, "but not as special as you." "Well, yeah." We both laughed. "I couldn't love you more, Violet." "I love you too, Daddy, so much." From that day on, his number one goal on every motivational chart and evaluation was, "Get strong so I can walk Violet down the aisle." The wedding date was set for November 17th, 2012. In June of 2012, Julian graduated from Colgate University, and my dad was well enough to make the trip. Leon and I drove up to Hamilton, New York for the day to celebrate Julian and see my dad. It was bittersweet. Dad was so proud of Julian and so happy to be there for the commencement that in some ways it felt like a great victory. But he also seemed overwhelmed and a little out of sorts to be so far from home. I couldn't help but think back to my own college graduation, cursing the fate that had my dad watching from the sidelines rather than standing behind the podium on stage, beaming his warmth and wisdom down on us all. Even though he still joked and laughed with us, when someone's grandfather sat down to talk with him, Dad signaled that he couldn't really hear and then looked to me to rescue him from the awkwardness. It felt so sad to see him this way, even at his best, so weak and vulnerable. Still, it was better than it had been, and I was guardedly optimistic that he might actually achieve his goal. After graduation, Julian moved back home to spend time with Dad and give Erica some additional support. From their reports, despite Dad's overall progress, each day seemed to present a different grueling challenge, and even with a team of amazing caregivers, there were days when only Erica or Julian could coax him into cooperating with even the most basic elements of his care. Later that summer, in preparation for an elective surgery, he was taken off his immunosuppressants and soon after suffered a relapse of the vasculitis, undoing all the progress he had made and plunging him deeper into the fog that his brain had become. That fall, as wedding plans came together and we started to think about the details of the ceremony, I really started to deal with the loss of my father. My therapist recommended the book Ambiguous Loss, and I read through it in 2 days. Written by a psychologist and intended for the families of Alzheimer's patients and others in here-but-not-here situations, such as soldiers missing in the line of duty, empty nesters, and so on, it explores the complicated grief process of saying goodbye to someone who is still physically present and letting go when there is no possibility of real closure. Even though he was still alive, my dad was no longer the person he used to be, and I needed to be able to mourn that person and let go of the expectation that he would return. I couldn't believe I was getting married in the first place, but it seemed even more surreal that my dad wouldn't be there. When I visited him at the end of October, he was in and out of awareness, definitely conscious, but more distant. It was as if the lesions in his brain were literal holes in his personality and memory. I wasn't sure if he even remembered I was getting married, but I felt I had to say something to acknowledge that this huge thing was happening and that he was going to miss it. As we were getting ready to go to the airport for our flight back to New York, I sat down by his bedside, took his hand, and said, "I'm so sorry, Daddy, but the doctors say you're not healthy enough to come to New York for the wedding next month. I'm going to miss you so much, and I'll be thinking of you the whole time. I hope you're not mad at me." "I could never be mad at you," he whispered. "Don't you worry. I'll be here." Keith ended up going to Chicago to be with my dad for the week while everyone else was in New York for the wedding and Thanksgiving. I'm so glad they were able to have that time together, and I think they were exactly what each other needed at exactly the right time. Over the next year and a half, Dad declined pretty steadily. He was back on the immunosuppressants he needed to control the vasculitis, but they made him susceptible to infection. He was having seizures and taking medications for that, but they were like tranquilizers and only increased his confusion and inertia. It was like a slowly sinking ship. We kept bailing the water out, but there were just too many cracks to fill. On a good day, he might let someone get him out of bed and sit him in the living room, where he would talk a little and smile. On a bad day, he wouldn't want to eat, was silent, and stared daggers at the caregivers who showed him endless love and patience. Still, when we visited, I would crawl into the twin-size hospital bed Erica had set up in his room and just lie there with him, trying to absorb whatever I could and offer him whatever comfort I could give. Karina, as anticipated, a hopeless daddy's girl herself, liked to dote on my dad and would rub lotion into his feet or make little circles on his temples with her tiny fingertips. Keon, understandably, didn't really know how to be with him, but would still go in every morning and kiss him, saying, "Hi, Grandpa, it's Keon, I love you," before running off to play basketball or video games. Just before my father died, Leon, Keon, Karina, and I spent the week in Chicago for the kids' midwinter break. Julian, Daniel, and Ida were there too. I had negotiated with Erica to let my mom come and visit while we were there, so she also got to spend a couple days with him that I know meant a lot to her. The rest of us were pretty down about his current state. He was barely talking and slept most of the day. I would go into his room and sit for a few minutes holding his hand, but I spent the majority of that trip watching Frozen with Karina in the living room. My mom, in her own world, as usual, was unfazed. He's there, she said, after spending over an hour just staring into his eyes. There's no doubt about it. I talked to him and he squeezed my hand. The way he looked at me, well, I'm not saying he's fine, but he's definitely there and still understanding and connecting. I wasn't seeing what she saw, but was glad that someone could still feel positive about the dismal state he was in. Erica and the boys and I had been discussing the possibility of hospice care since a particularly severe seizure had sent him to the emergency room the month before. None of us thought he should go back to the hospital to be poked and prodded when, ultimately, there was simply nothing they could do for him. Before we left to return to New York, I sat down by his bed, kissed his face, and held his hand. He opened his eyes and smiled weakly. I'm leaving, Daddy. I love you so much. I want you to know that you are always in my heart and on my mind. Every time I laugh, I think of you and all the times we laughed together. Every time I eat something delicious, I think of you and how much you would enjoy it. Every time I'm sad, I think of you and how you could always make me feel better. Every time I'm confused, I think about you and how smart you are and how you always seem to make everything make sense. Every time I'm happy, I think of you and how happy I am to be your daughter and how I want you to be happy too. So, basically, all the time. You're with me forever. He tapped my hand with his finger and closed his eyes. I walked out of the room crying, knowing it might be the last time I saw him. When we got back to New York, Erica called to say that he was refusing to eat or take his meds and she was going to call the hospice coordinator. I got on a flight back to Chicago the next day. Erica, Julian, Daniel, Molly, Laurel, two caregivers, two close family friends, and I sat in a semicircle around my dad's bed as he lay there, dying. His breaths were shallow and uneven, loudly rattling in his throat. Each time his breathing paused, we all froze, wondering if this was it. Then he would snort again, and we would unfreeze and exhale. Not yet. At one point, Erica and I started giggling because it was so intense and we were all so in the moment, and here he was, our beloved, snoring into the void. I wasn't conscious of time as we sat there. It could have been 5 minutes or an eternity. Finally, at 1:53 a.m. on February 24th, 2014, my father stopped breathing and didn't start again. Life after death. Dad and I used to fit our faces together like two puzzle pieces, with my cheek in his eye socket or vice versa, two halves of a whole. Watching him drift away as his brain function deteriorated was heartbreaking. There was so much of him in me. I felt like I was losing myself, too. Sometimes I even thought that I was feeling his sadness from inside myself. It was devastating, not just losing him as an amazing father, brilliant mind, voice of a generation, godfather of modern comedy, but also losing the potential of what he saw in people. Who would write all those letters of recommendation now? Who would recognize something special in an intern or a waiter or in me? Who was there to make proud now? I've never felt more like an adult and more like a child at the same time. As soon as news of my dad's death began to spread, the phone did not stop ringing and the emails and Facebook messages kept pouring in. It was emotionally overwhelming and somehow almost exhilarating at the same time. From generic but genuine condolences and cherished memories from people we knew, to heartfelt and very personal stories from complete strangers about what my dad's work had meant to them, I read and reread them all, savoring and hoarding these bits of collective sorrow like gold. Violet, your dad was a real-life George Bailey, and there are so many people whose lives he changed who are heartbroken today. More, I'm sure, than we'll ever have the opportunity to tell you. I have not seen your family for so long, yet I find myself flooded with memories and sadness and gratitude for having known him at all. I am picturing him sitting on the couch at Ocean Pictures, strumming his gut-string guitar, singing Blackbird, and, for comic effect, Kumbaya. Your dad on so many levels has made my childhood to my adult life a little more positive. I loved his writing, directing, and acting. From Vacation to Analyze This, he has made me laugh and smile for so many years, and of course, Ghostbusters was a massive part of my life. Mr. Ramis was and always will be a part of my life. When I was a little boy, I was abused and held that secret until I was 30 years old. It was films like Vacation and Ghostbusters that gave me a window into happiness and escapism. Your dad has done more for so many than I think he realized, and my life wasn't easy, but he and Dan made it a little more easy. I am so very sad to hear about the passing of Harold Ramis, truly one of the greats. To this day, working with him was one of my fondest filmmaking experiences ever, one which I felt so lucky to have had. He was always a gentleman, always funny, and always inspired the best in everyone around him. My deepest condolences to Violet and his family. Rest in peace, Harold, and thank you for everything you did and left behind. You will inspire laughs and joy for lifetimes yet to come. This may sound silly, but when I heard of his passing, I was upset for a few weeks and even wore black for a few days. Honestly, felt like part of my own family passed away. Your father was a wonderful actor who I totally adore and still watch religiously. Really looking forward to reading your book about him. Hope you don't mind me contacting you telling you this information. All the best to you and your family. Hi, Violet. I don't know if you remember me, but I met you at Beethoven School in the late 90s with your dad. I worked with your dad on and off for a few years on small projects because he was trying to get involved in helping the public schools. I wound up making introductions for him to the Chicago International Children's Film Festival, Street Level Youth Media, and several others. And then I also wrote about his work trying to bring film production to Chicago for the Sun-Times. We stayed connected over the years through various changes in life, and he was always willing to make an introduction or lend me a hand. My mother died in 1998, and I read Irvin Yalom's Existential Psychotherapy on Harold's recommendation to get through that loss. When I came to Buddhist-type spirituality in the early aughts, your dad and I stayed connected that way as well. I've been planning on writing something about him, but I'm still grappling with finding the adequate language. As you know, your dad was an exceptional person. He was politically astute, far more than I am, and saw right through posturing and grandstanding. He always treated me with kindness and respect, unlike the political folk who brought me to him in the first place. I met him right after I left Mayor Richard Daley's office. I wish he had left a book about living a good life for all of us to enjoy afterward. Thank goodness he left us his wonderful movies. I have many treasured memories of your dad. If you're ever in Chicago, I'd love to meet and catch up. Blessings to you and your family. I moved through the days immediately following his death in an altered state, making arrangements for the funeral, accepting what seemed like an endless stream of flowers and baskets of food, and checking in constantly with my mom, Erica, my siblings, and my kids to make sure everyone was okay, or as okay as they could be anyway. The private funeral service was held at North Shore Congregation Israel and presided over by Jordan Bendat Appel, a young rabbi who had been very close to my father and family. The guitar my dad had made sat in a stand in front of his coffin, and Bob Dylan played softly in the background as friends and family filled the synagogue. I spoke, as did Erica, Julian, Daniel, Ida, Trevor Albert, and my dad's best friend from college, David. At the cemetery, a bitterly cold wind whipped across the frozen ground, and Chevy Chase cracked a joke along the lines of, "Thanks a lot, Harold," which made everyone laugh through their tears and chattering teeth. As gut-wrenching as his actual death was, I had been struggling to accept losing him to his illness for so long by that point that I felt mostly numb as people hugged me, sobbing and begging me to let them know if there was anything they could do to help. We sat Shiva for the next 4 days. Erica's three best friends, bless them, handled all of the catering, security, and communication issues as hundreds of people, family, friends, colleagues, community members, and congregants, came through the house to eat, drink, pray, and pay their respects. In June, we had a more public memorial at the Montabong Theater in Hollywood, attended by more than 600 people and emceed by SCTV alum and longtime friend Marty Short. with substantial logistical and emotional support from Second City CEO Andrew Alexander, Erica gathered an amazing group of people to speak about my dad and the impact he had on their lives and on the world of comedy. Martin Short, Joe Flaherty, Dave Thomas, Andrea Martin, Steve Carell, Eugenie Ross Lemming, Stephen Campman, Judith Kahn, Michael Schamberg, and Billy Crystal all spoke in person, while Eugene Levy, Catherine O'Hara, Al Franken, Jack Black, Seth Rogen, and Judd Apatow sent messages via video. In my speech, I mentioned that my dad and I had talked about writing a book together, and several people approached me afterward, encouraging me to go ahead with the idea. And so, here we are. The strange thing about losing someone as prolific as my dad is that he left so much of himself behind after his death through his work and public life. I don't have to wonder what he thought about the meaning of life or how he made sense of the world. I can watch the video of his soul pancake conversation with Rainn Wilson, with a portrait of me that my mom painted hanging on the wall behind him like a guardian angel, and hear him say that it's up to us to find and create substantive purpose to guide and animate our lives. I can trace his creative and philosophical evolution by watching his movies and reading through the hundreds of articles and interviews pasted into my grandfather's scrapbooks. I can laugh with him through the presentation he gave at the Chicago Humanities Festival on his favorite comedies. Even though I am very grateful to still be able to access him in so many ways, it'll never be enough. As wonderful as all these artifacts are, they pale in comparison to the actual man my dad was. For as long as I can remember, people have been telling me how much I am like my father. This is a compliment I have a hard time wrapping my head around, especially since his death. It all made sense when we were together, but without him, who am I? How can I keep his incredible qualities going without him? And what if I can't? So, I wrote this book in part to remember, and so my children can remember, and to try, in whatever small way I can, to capture some of his greatness and share it with you. I loved my dad more than anything in this world, and I know he loved me with everything he had. And if that ends up being the greatest accomplishment of my life, being his and making him proud, that's meaning enough for me. Dear Dad, so I wrote the book, Now What? It's been more than 3 years since you left us, 7 if you count the slow and torturous withdrawal of your illness, and I still feel the ache of your absence as deeply as I did on day one. How is it even possible that life has gone on and so many things have happened without you? Sitting here, reading and rereading our story, I can't help but wonder what your big takeaway would be from all this. To me, it kind of feels like a postmodern fairy tale, full of magic, peril, and interesting characters, but lacking in morality and the satisfaction of an uncomplicated happy ending. We ate the poisoned apples, but just got a mild case of Montezuma's revenge. We built the strongest house we could, but the wolf got in anyway. I guess even the classic heroes made a lot of mistakes, but what did we learn from ours? If there's no true measure of right and wrong, good and bad, then, in the end, what does it all mean? Barring the obvious extremes, how much does being a good person and parent really even matter? What would you have done differently if given the chance? See, Daddy? Without your light to guide me, it's so easy to get lost in all this ambiguity. There are so many questions that no one can answer for me now. Even though I know what you would probably say, the most profound answers only come from within ourselves. There is no objective truth. The journey of seeking is more important than the destination of knowing. Still, there's nothing I wouldn't give to discuss it with you over a Big Mac and some Blue Dream. As much as I miss you every day and irrationally wish for your miraculous reappearance, the truth is, Dad, I'm okay. I'm okay because you live on in me and I carry you with me wherever I go. I can hear your voice in my head telling me how proud you are of this book, reassuring me that I'm a good enough mom and insisting that I'm a decent person, in spite of what everyone says, ha ha. So, instead of ending with heartbreak, I'll go with gratitude. Thank you for being the perfectly imperfect person you were and for making me the person I am today. Thank you for being the best father I could have ever imagined and for loving me with all your heart. Thank you, Daddy, for everything, always. I love you. Violet. This is Violet Ramis Steele. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Ghostbuster's Daughter, Life with My Dad, Harold Ramis. This program was directed by Scott Sherritt with Olivia Mackenzie Smith. Executive producer, Diane McKiernan. Text copyright 2018 by Violet Ramis Steele. Production copyright 2018, Penguin Random House, LLC. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.